This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents The Killing Jar by Jennifer Bosworth, narrated by Saskia Marleveld. All that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 1. Prologue. The Killing. I try not to think about it, that time I killed a boy. But the problem with trying not to think about something is that you'll think about it even more. So that's what I do. I think about it. I dream about it. I obsess. But I never, ever talk about him, the boy whose life I took. I didn't want to kill him. At least, I don't think I did. Or maybe that's just what I tell myself so I can live with what I am, what I did, how I did it. I was 10 years old, and so was he. His name was Jason Dunn, and on the outside he appeared as normal as his name. His family lived next door to mine on the outskirts of town. My bedroom window gave me a direct view of the path to the river. I watched Jason take that path every day after school. He always came back smiling to himself, in a way that made me feel cold and queasy, like I'd eaten something bad. So I followed him, and I found out why he smiled like that. Jason liked to kill. Insignificant things, mostly. Small murders that would go unnoticed. He chopped up worms into wriggling segments and fried them with a magnifying glass. He pulled the wings from moths or misted trails of ants with hairspray and set them on fire. Miniature tortures that parents tend to write off as boys being boys. Cruelty as a phase, like puberty. Jason's preferred method of torment was to put butterflies in his killing jar, the kind entomologists use to kill insects quickly without damaging their specimens. There was a swab of poison in the bottom, a fast-acting toxin. Although Jason had a corkboard where he pinned dead butterflies and moths, beetles and spiders, he brought his collection to school every time we had show and tell. He wasn't in it for the scientific observation. He just liked to watch things die. But then he went too far. My twin sister, Erin, is allergic to everything with fur, so our mom wouldn't let her have pets. Still, she secretly adopted a strange orange cat with a missing ear and a scar over one eye that liked to hang around our house, especially after she started leaving food out for it. She named it Clint Eastwood because its squinty eye reminded her of the classic Eastwood glare, and Erin was going through a spaghetti western phase. It turned out the cat was a female, though. She had a litter of kittens in the shed behind our house. Erin and I visited the mother and brought her clean towels and bowls of tuna fish. We watched her kittens jitter and worm about, figuring out how to use their weak limbs, mewling in tolerant protest as Clint licked them clean. Their mother purred like an engine while her brood fed. One day the kittens' eyes were sealed tightly shut, the next they were open and black, and fuzz covered their bodies. But when we came back to see them the next day, the kittens were gone, and so was their mother. Erin was distraught. She begged me to search the woods for her cat and the kittens. She just wanted to know they were all right. Erin couldn't be a part of the search because of her condition, which was what we called it for lack of a name that ran the gamut of my twins' maladies. Defective heart, weak bones, anemia, asthma, severe allergies, autoimmune disorders. It was better that Erin didn't come with me to search for her pet anyway. Better she never had the image of what I found trapped in her head. I knew as soon as I found Clint Eastwood's mangled body by the river, surrounded by her drowned litter, that this was Jason's work. But if I needed further proof, I got it when I saw him at school the next day, his hands covered in raw red scratches. Clint Eastwood put up a fight. Good for her. I told Erin I couldn't find Clint Eastwood and the kittens, but in truth I buried them in the woods and marked their grave with a pile of river stones. While I dug the grave with my bare hands, I thought about how I was going to make Jason pay for what he'd done. I could have told my mom what Jason was up to, but I doubted she would believe me. Jason was an expert at hiding the monster inside him. He was unfailingly polite to adults. He never got into trouble at school. He was quiet, but not too quiet. He played sports, but he wasn't too aggressive, never pouted when his team lost. He was everyone's idea of the perfect kid, and I had no evidence to prove otherwise. If someone was going to teach Jason a lesson, it had to be me. I wanted it to be me, because even though Aaron and I didn't have the kind of uncanny twin connection that allowed me to read her mind, I felt it when she was in pain. She was a part of me, and Jason had taken from her one of the few things that made her happy. So I was going to take something from Jason, because I could. Because I had recently come to understand that I wasn't like other people. "You have a gift that very few people in this world possess," my mom told me in confidence. "But you must never use it. Promise me you'll never use it, Kenna, because you're too young to control it, and if you start, I don't know if you'll be able to stop." So I promised, but my promise was a lie. If someone tells you that you're special, that you can do something extraordinary, you have to try it at least once. 3 days after I buried Clint Eastwood, I trailed Jason into the woods, observing him, stalking him the way I imagined he stalked his doomed victims. He caught a monarch butterfly in his net and let out a whoop of triumph before inserting it into his killing jar. "Can I see?" I asked, stepping from the trees and walking slowly toward him, my arms hanging loose and casual at my sides. I didn't want to seem like a threat, not until it was too late. He clutched the jar to his chest, like I might try to take it from him. "Why?" he asked, his eyes empty, not the eyes he showed to adults. These were his real eyes, his vacant crow's eyes. I didn't answer his question. I lowered my gaze to the jar and the butterfly trapped inside, its crisp wings the color of Halloween, velvet black and flame orange. The butterfly beat against the walls of its glass prison until it lost the will to fight and drooped against the bottom like wilted lettuce. Jason's empty eyes beamed with excitement then, and fury uncoiled in me like a rising cobra. He never saw it coming. I grabbed Jason by the wrist and felt something unfurl from my skin, connecting me to him like a shared vein. His mouth opened in a distended O, but he couldn't scream. I didn't give him the chance. His life, his essence, a sensation like rising and expanding, like I'd swallowed a sunrise, flooded my body. At the same time, Jason's color waned from pale to waxy gray. His skin shriveled into a dehydrated shell. The hair fell from his head in hunks. His eyes turned black as underground tunnels, and his cheekbones protruded in chalky white wings. When he fell, his killing jar hit a rock, and glass exploded like brittle fireworks. I've never told anyone about the hurricane of raucous, feral energy that poured from Jason into me, so heady and rapturous that it almost lifted me off the ground. It told me I could do anything, run 1,000 miles, swim an ocean, live forever, raise the dead. Anything. It was all within my grasp. It told me I was a god. I knelt beside the shattered killing jar and cupped the limp butterfly in my palms. I touched its wing with the tip of my finger and watched as a hair-thin strand of white light emerged and attached briefly to the insect's thorax. The wings stiffened and twitched. A moment later, the monarch juddered into the sky and vanished from sight. Then I ran. Not because I'd killed Jason Dunn, but because it was the only thing I could think to do with the energy boiling in me like rocket fuel. I raced through the woods, across the river where Jason had drowned the kittens, and into the mountains. When I finally returned home 2 days later, the euphoria that had filled me after I killed Jason was gone, and I needed it back. I was certain I would die without it, or that I was already dead, because that was what it felt like to lose the light I'd taken from inside Jason. Who knew there could be so much light inside someone whose soul, if he had one, was so dark? I could tell as soon as my mom opened the door that she knew what I had done, and what I wanted to do. To take again, and take and take, to drive away the dead hollowness inside and replace it with perfect euphoria. A fever took hold of my body and pushed acid sweat from my pores. My stomach seized and cramped, and I doubled over, retching up searing bile. My organs acted like they were shutting down. My blood thickened and decelerated to an oily crawl in my veins, and my heartbeat slowed and then revved. A sensation like I was covered with biting insects tortured my skin until I scratched it raw. "You were right," I told Mom, sweating and holding myself and raking my arms bloody. "You have to take me away and lock me up, or I'll do something terrible." Mom said nothing, only nodded and gave me some of Aaron's pills to knock me out. And when I woke up, I was in an empty room alone. A room with a locked door and no windows. I wasn't sure how long she kept me there. 5 days? 10? 30? I lost track of time as the fever melted my skin and invisible pincers snapped at my insides. Imaginary army ants chewed on my flesh, and my stomach heaved and heaved even when there was nothing inside it. My throat tore, and I coughed blood until I passed out. I tried to forget why I was locked in the room. I tried not to hear my mom crying when she brought me food I couldn't keep down, telling me she was sorry. Sorry for what I was. When she finally let me out, I was string thin and wasted and unwashed. But I was under control. Mom studied me a long time before responding. "What you did to that boy, you can never do that again." "I know," I told her. "We can never talk about this," she said. "Not ever. We have to pretend it never happened."
"Okay."
I began to cry. Both of us did.
"You have to be normal. Be just like everyone else."
"I'll be normal. I will."
Mom and I never talked about my dangerous secret again, or about my confinement, or about Jason Dunn. Sometimes it feels like we haven't really spoken since the day she let me out of the locked room. We move our mouths and sounds come out, but we never actually say anything. Aside from my mom, no one knows the truth about me, and I hope they never will. What happened with Jason can't happen again. I won't let it, though every time I touch another person, I feel the life contained within them like a bottle waiting to be uncorked. So I never touch people if I can avoid it, just like I never tell anyone what really happened to Jason Dunn. I keep distance between me and everyone else, because the temptation is too much. Often I wake in a desperate, greedy fever, remembering how taking Jason's life felt like drinking sunlight and eternity, and I want more. So much more. I want life. Not my own, but theirs. Every life but my own. But I try not to think about that either, because thinking leads to wanting. And wanting always, inevitably, leads to taking. Gray Girl. Sometimes you forget you're alive until you're scared to death. As I took in the massing herd of festival attendees, I felt more alive than I had in years. Alive and sick, my stomach churning like a cyclone. I should have skipped dinner, and probably lunch, and breakfast too, because I was likely about to lose them all in front of hundreds of people. "Nervous?" Blake asked, eyeing me from the driver's seat. The endless line of cars we'd been trapped behind began to move, and a parking attendant wearing a tie-dyed t-shirt waved us forward.
"Nope," I said, my voice trembling.
"Not a bit."
"Seriously?"
He looked so hopeful I hated to disappoint him. "You know how people always say they have butterflies in their stomach when they're nervous? I have ostriches. A stampeding army of ostriches. I envy the people of butterflies. They don't know how lucky they are."
"Hey," he said. "You have nothing to be nervous about because you're going to kick ass. B, I'm stealing your ostriches. Think of it, an army of savage alien ostriches living on a squishy pink planet that resembles the lining of a stomach."
"Sounds homey," I said. In a week, Blake would have drawn a whole new comic inspired by my anxiety and posted it to his blog.
"You better at least dedicate the story to me." to my reluctant muse, Kenna, and her stomach full of ostriches. Blake grinned at me, but seeing my expression, his amusement curdled to a sheepish cringe.
Are you really freaking out?
You said this was a small festival, I reminded him. I was not prepared for this. I gestured toward the stage and the sea of festival goers.
Well, I've never been to a music festival. I didn't have anything to compare it to.
A female parking attendant wearing tube socks and cut-off Daisy Duke shorts directed Blake toward a space that looked barely big enough to accommodate a motorcycle. By some miracle, he managed to wedge his rattling forerunner into the space, and the short shorts-wearing attendant gave him a double thumbs-up and a dizzy grin. Blake smiled back at her, and a pang of jealousy gonged in my chest. He's not your boyfriend, I reminded myself. He can check out whomever he wants. Still, I couldn't help glaring at short shorts through the passenger window. She sneered at me and turned away, but not before I read the words printed on her tie-dyed festival shirt. Folk Yeah Fest 2016. Folk you, folk me, folk everybody.
Either way, it's too late to back out now, Blake said. Someone's already blocked us in.
The parking was tandem, and we were jammed in front and back. There would be no leaving until the festival was over, until my song was over. My heart began to pound so hard I could feel it in my kneecaps. Can we sit here a little longer? I asked.
We need to get you signed in.
Please, 1 minute, that's all I need. That was not all I needed, but it was all I was going to get. The engine idled. An old-fashioned string band called Long Way Home played through the speakers. I'd introduced Blake to them as part of his musical reprogramming. When I'd first met Blake at the beginning of our junior year, after his family moved into the house next door that used to belong to the Dunns, his iPod playlist had been in a sad state, filled with such no-brainer top 40 hitmakers as Miley Cyrus, John Mayer, Maroon 5, and, God help me, Kesha.
Ah, you're a music snob, he'd deduced after I'd told him every 12-year-old girl in America called and said she wanted her taste in music back.
Blake had good-naturedly shrugged off my teasing.
So I'm not a music person.
That's because you're listening to the wrong music.
Then teach me, wise one, he'd challenged, and I accepted.
3 months later, Blake was not only listening to Tom Waits and Father John Misty and a few dozen other respectable musicians, but I'd started giving him guitar lessons. I suspected he still listened to his top 40 staples when I wasn't around, but even a music snob like me couldn't turn my nose up at a song solely because it was popular. I just tended to like things old school, before voice modulation software and glorified karaoke competitions that churned out universally acceptable talent. But then, 2 weeks ago, Blake threw down a gauntlet of his own. A gauntlet that came in the form of a flyer announcing a music festival called Folk Yeah Fest. And one of the features of the festival was a competition for emerging artists. Participants would play one original song in front of the Folk Yeah audience. The audience members would vote, and the winner would have a song professionally produced and included on the Folk Yeah compilation album. Blake had signed me up without telling me, claiming it was better to ask forgiveness than permission. I tried to decline, but it was too late. Blake had told Erin about the competition, and she demanded I go through with it.
It's my dying wish, she proclaimed, making me wince.
I would never get used to Erin's cavalier attitude toward the likely chance of her own premature death. You play that dying wish card once a week, I said, but Erin propped her garden hose arms on her bony hips and narrowed her eyes at me behind her thick glasses.
If you don't play at this festival, I'll never forgive you, she amended.
I sighed and said yes, as if I'd ever had a choice. It was impossible to say no to Erin when I didn't know how much longer she'd be around.
Your minute is up, Blake said and killed the engine.
Long Way Home's hectic but harmonious guitar-banjo duet went silent, and the muffled strains of live music coming from the stage replaced it. My heart started beating in kick drum bursts. The passages between my throat and lungs narrowed, signaling an oncoming asthma attack. I fished in my bag and found my emergency inhaler. Are you okay?
Blake's eyes widened in alarm. I tried never to use my inhaler in front of him or anyone else. It made people nervous, I'd observed, and I already had a tendency to make people nervous.
Yeah, fine.
I sprayed my lungs with an acrid fog of medicine, and the tension in my chest eased. Blake stuffed his keys into his jacket pocket, but made no move to open the car door.
Kenna, if you really want to withdraw...
No, I promised Aaron. But my promise wasn't the only reason I needed to finish what I, or technically Blake, had started. I was about to start my last year of high school, and I had no desire to follow graduation with any of the things that sounded responsible, going to college and majoring in something practical, in the hopes of someday getting a normal job and securing a normal life as if I were some normal girl. Normal lives were for normal people, and I was not one of them. I reached for the door handle.
Let's go. The longer I sit here, the more likely I am to chicken out.
We went around to the back of the 4Runner, and Blake popped the trunk. I reached for my guitar in its scuffed, black, hard case, covered in scraps of my favorite lyrics scrawled with silver pen. Blake beat me to the handle and picked up the guitar.
I'll carry it for you.
Oh, thanks. I would rather have carried it myself. My guitar was like an extension of me, a horcrux containing a piece of my soul. It was a gift from my mom, given to me shortly after the Jason Dunn incident, after I stopped touching other people or letting them touch me. She didn't encourage me to change my new rule. Instead, she brought me something I could touch without worrying whether I would hurt it. She taught me my first few cowboy chords, and then I was off to the races, teaching myself to play using video tutorials and songbooks I ordered online. But I let Blake be the chivalrous guy he wanted to be and carry my guitar because it made him happy. He was always doing stuff like that, opening doors for me, offering to let me try whatever he was eating, laughing at my jokes even if they weren't funny. I wanted to tell him to stop trying so hard to win me over. I was already won. He had me from the moment he'd knocked on our door to introduce himself and offered oatmeal raisin cookies he'd made himself. I hated raisins, but apparently I was a sucker for boy-next-door types like Blake, who looked like a shy English prep school student with his pale, freckled skin and his thick brown hair parted on the side. He was the kind of guy who belonged in a school uniform with a striped tie and a blazer, whose cheeks turned bright pink in the wind. His innate sweetness was, to a lost ship like me, a beacon in a black night. But I couldn't admit that to Blake, because if I did, he would want us to change our relationship status from just friends to something more complicated, and that was where things got tricky. It wouldn't work, and I'd end up losing my best friend. Unacceptable. Besides, what guy wanted a girlfriend who wouldn't let him touch her? We headed for the wide-open field, where a stage jutted from the landscape, and were ingested in the flow of people heading in the same direction. The festival had been going on since noon. Blake and I could have arrived earlier and seen some of my favorite indie folk bands play, but I'd needed the extra hours to rehearse my song. I'd probably practiced too long. The tips of my fingers were sore, and my throat felt raw as a scraped knee. The crowd pressed in around us, and I felt my back stiffen. I tried to make myself smaller so I could avoid touching anyone around me, but it didn't work. Some stoned guy wearing a slouchy beanie cap stepped on the back of my heel. A college-age girl taking a selfie elbowed me in the arm. Suddenly, Blake's shoulder was pressed right up against mine, the back of his hand against my hand. I felt the life under his skin, warm and bright and ebullient. I jerked away, my heart rattling like machine gun fire.
Sorry.
Blake looked startled.
I'd give you space if there was any.
Don't worry about it, I said, trying to sound casual, even though I was the one who drilled it into Blake's mind that he should worry about it. I'd never figured out the right explanation to give Blake about my no-touching rule. If there was anyone I did want to touch, it was him, especially when he looked the way he did tonight, trying so hard to fit in that he'd made himself even more conspicuous. Clean-cut, East Coast preppy, masquerading as a scuzzy hipster. Still, he blended better than I did. With my blonde hair bleached and tinted the color of a gloomy sky, wearing my signature Shades of Grey ensemble. I looked like a watered-down goth girl with the dragon tattoo. Light. The rest of the festival attendees were a sprawling patchwork of color and texture, flower prints and neon and plaid, leather and lace and suede fringe, denim and dreads, hair dyed lavender, cotton candy pink and blue, mermaid green, sunset shades of orange and magenta. People dressed as decades, ranging from the Gatsby era to the stonewashed 80s. Compared to the rest of the festival goers, I was as drab as smog, but I didn't really care. Gray was how I felt, so I wore my spirit color openly. It was the one true aspect of myself I showed to the world. Except I didn't feel gray around Blake. That was the best and worst thing about him. I was used to gray. I wasn't prepared to deal with the rest of the spectrum he brought out in me. Blake did the talking at the sign-in table, where a man and woman who looked like they'd time-traveled to the festival from the Dust Bowl era, the man wearing a pork pie hat and suspenders, the woman in an unflattering vintage sack dress with a Peter Pan collar and buttons down the front, handed me a document to sign and a square of paper with the number 7 printed on it. "Kenna Marsden, you are lucky number 7, our last performer for the competition. I was worried you weren't going to show up." She beamed at me. "I loved your entry song. Is that the one you'll be singing?" I nodded, feeling dazed as I stared at the number in my hand. There were only 7 entries? "Oh no, we had hundreds, but we winnowed it down to our favorites." She gave me more instructions, but I felt like I was listening through a wall. Luckily, Blake was attentive enough for both of us. "Good luck," the sign-in girl called as we headed toward the stage. "See," Blake said. "Hundreds of entries and you were one of 7 chosen. That has to make you feel good." It was impossible to explain to Blake why I rarely felt good about anything. Blake's family bought the house that had formerly belonged to the Dunns, but as far as I knew, he was ignorant of the tragic fate of the Dunn family. After losing their only child, Jason's parents got divorced, his dad lost his job, and shortly after that lost his mind. He was remanded to a psychiatric hospital in Portland, where, rumor had it, he raved about how his son's soul had been sucked out of his body by a demon girl. That would be me, the one who'd been with Jason when he died, who had run from the scene and vanished into the mountains. Fortunately, Mr. Dunn was the only person who had jumped to the right conclusion. Blake stepped in front of me, forcing me to stop. His expression was adorably stern, like a little boy pretending to be a drill sergeant. "Come on, Kenna. You spend all this time making me listen to other people's music, when your stuff is just as good, and you hoard it away like it's some shameful secret. No matter what else happens tonight, just be proud of yourself for 2 seconds. I gritted my teeth to keep the truth contained. I would never be like him. Blake drew his quirky, deranged comics and posted them on his blog without a second thought. The comments people left ranged from fanatical praise to troll scum vitriol. But when I asked him if the belligerent comments bothered him, he just shrugged. "It's not personal." But the songs I wrote, the lyrics, the mournful, funereal, guilt-drenched melodies, those told the truth I guarded so carefully, the truth I could never admit, or I might see the answering candor in the eyes of someone I cared about. Condemnation, disgust, revulsion. "He doesn't understand," I thought, "because he doesn't know his best friend is a murderer. He doesn't realize that if you do something bad enough, it follows you for the rest of your life." I didn't get a chance to answer his question. We were interrupted by Aaron's voice shouting my name. "Kenna, there you are!" I turned and saw my bespectacled twin waving, our mom at her elbow. I gasped as Aaron darted into the crowd, weaving past a grouplet of hipsters and hippies. I sped to Aaron's side and snarled at the few jolly festival goers who didn't get out of her way quickly enough. "Are you okay?" I asked, looking her over as though she'd been in a car accident. Anyone who didn't know Aaron was my twin would never have believed we were even the same age, much less two halves of the same egg. Aaron was so small and scrawny she could have passed for a malnourished little girl version of Keith Richards. There was no official name for the condition that forbade Aaron from thriving in the body with which she'd been born. Whatever it was, It kept my mom and me in a constant state of alarm. Erin's bones were so brittle she could trip on a crack in the sidewalk and fracture her ankle, and her blood's so thin she was liable to pass out if she had to stand too long. She had a bad heart along with asthmatic tendencies, but where my asthma seemed to manifest only during moments of stress, hers was exacerbated by pollution, exercise, dust, and 100 other things I could list from memory.
"When do you go on?" Erin
asked, pushing up her comically thick glasses, which had slid to the tip of her nose.
"Are you freaking out? I'm freaking out. Did you know Lorde was only 17 when she won a Grammy? That could be you."
"If I ever win a Grammy, it will be because of you," I told her. Erin was the only person I never turned away when I was working on a song. I let her sit in the basement and listen to me play as long as she wanted. She may have had a broken body, but her mind was sharp and analytical. If my entry for Folk Yeah had impressed anyone, it was partly thanks to Erin's critical ear. Our mom wrestled her way through the crowd to reach us. She must have come straight from her bakery, Need. Flour powdered her jeans and her shoulder-length blonde hair, which she always cut at home with a pair of scissors that needed sharpening. I had a vague childhood memory, my first memory, of my mom's hair long as a horse's tail, of sitting on her lap and wrapping myself in it like hiding inside a curtain. I would have thought I was imagining this version of my mom, but for the huge, intricate tattoo of a moth on her back, stretching across both her shoulders like a shawl. Whoever Mom had been before she had Erin and me, she must have been a lot more interesting than she was now. There was also the matter of our father, or lack thereof, and how Mom told us she didn't know his name. But Erin and I had done the math, and we knew our mom had been only 18 when she gave birth to us. Much of her passion for life must have been lost to the stress of having one daughter who'd been knocking on death's door since she was born, and another who had sent someone through that door. Mom took Erin's chin in her hand and tipped her head up to her face. "I told you to stay right next to me," she said, as though she were speaking to a 5-year-old who'd wandered away in the grocery store. Erin rolled her eyes, but redness crept into her pale cheeks. She was used to our mom treating her like a baby in front of me, but in front of Blake it was another story. "Give her a break, Mom," I said. "A break is what she'll get if she falls or gets knocked down out here."
"Can you guys please not talk about me like I'm not here?" Erin said, her voice small and barely audible over the buzz of the crowd.
Mom and I shared an anxious glance, and I knew we were both thinking the same thing. If Erin's doctors were to be believed, Erin wouldn't be here much longer. My twin was dying, and she had been all her life, ever since she was born blue and cold and with a hole in her heart. Our mom, too, had nearly died during childbirth, right along with her. Afterwards, she told us in a rare moment of openness, she went through a period of postpartum depression so vicious that she had considered suicide. She probably would have gone through with it if it weren't for the fact that we would have become orphans without her. But Mom's postpartum depression had never really ended, and I thought I might have inherited my own depression issues from her. Then again, we both had plenty of practical reasons to be depressed, the first of which was the constant threat of losing the person we loved most. When she was a baby, Erin's doctors said she probably wouldn't make it to her 5th birthday, but she had. Then they told us she wouldn't make it to her 10th birthday, but she had. Then they said she wouldn't make it to 15, and here she was, 17 and still alive. But the thing I didn't tell Mom, that I hardly dared admit to myself, was that I had begun to sense a change in Erin. I couldn't explain it, but when I was near her, I felt her diminishing fast, the life hissing out of her like she'd sprung a leak. But Erin didn't live like she was dying. She hadn't attended school since an accident on the playground in 5th grade, but Mom had homeschooled her, and Erin had already gotten her GED and was taking online college courses. One would think she'd prefer to spend her time enjoying herself, but her nightstand and desk were stacked with books that made my brain hurt just to look at them. Historical biographies, Victorian novels, anything by Carl Sagan, Stephen Hawking, or Neil deGrasse Tyson. I was in awe of her. If I'd been the one in her situation, I probably would have spent the majority of my time locked in my room crying and cursing God or whoever for dealing me such a crappy hand. Most of the time I tried not to think about Aaron's condition, but with the stress of my first live performance bearing down on me, and Aaron and Blake looking at me with such hopeful expectations, it was all too much. Tears burned the backs of my eyes, and my mind whirled like a top about to spin off a table. "I can't do this," I muttered, but no one heard me because I couldn't get enough air into my lungs to make myself heard. How was I supposed to sing when I couldn't breathe? Then someone in a Folk Yeah t-shirt was calling out my number, beckoning me toward the side entrance to the stage. Blake pushed my guitar case into my hands and whispered, "You're going to be great." Aaron clapped and squealed with excitement. My mom shocked me by reaching out and brushing a lock of gray hair back behind my ear. I couldn't remember the last time my mom had touched me, and I sucked in a breath as I felt the promise of energy restrained beneath her skin. My immediate impulse was to reach for it, to pull that energy into me, but I set my teeth and refused to comply. Mom withdrew her hand quickly. "Go on," she said, her smile sad and anxious and twitching a little at the corners. "Show them what you can do." I swallowed a fist-sized lump in my throat and nodded. It happened fast and achingly slow at the same time. A festival liaison briefed me, then a sound technician mic'd my acoustic guitar, and before I knew it, I was walking up a short flight of steps and onto a stage, looking out at hundreds of faces. I searched for Blake and my family, but didn't see them. My eyes stopped on a middle-aged man with gray at his temples. He looked out of place with his brown hunting jacket and his dead, black stare. He reminded me of someone, but I couldn't decide who. And was it my imagination, the hatred and rage he projected toward me from those cold eyes of his? My heartbeat thundered. I began to tremble and panic and reached automatically for my emergency inhaler, thinking, one person in the audience already hates me, and I'm supposed to sing. But my bag was gone, and I had a vague memory of handing it to the festival liaison to hold until I was finished. Could I subtly hint for her to bring it to me? Leave the stage for a second to retrieve it? I tore my gaze from the man in the hunting jacket, and my eyes finally landed on Blake, right in the front row, just off to the side, so I hadn't been able to spot him right away. He stood with my mom and Aaron. Aaron was smiling so wide her jaw would probably be sore tomorrow. She had never in her life been allowed to attend an event like this, and she probably never would again. My twin met my eyes, reading the distress on my face, and mouthed one word, "Breathe." I did. Everything after that was a blur. When the music's over, I rested my forehead against the chilly glass of the passenger side window and watched the road slide by beneath Blake's forerunner, a fast-moving conveyor belt carrying us home. But I didn't want to go home, because then this night would be over. "Can we keep driving?" I asked. To my bass-numbed ears, my voice sounded like it came from the bottom of a lake. My mom and Aaron had left the festival shortly after I played, but Blake and I had stayed to hear the rest of the bands. For hours, we'd lost ourselves in music and voices, in black night and white stars. I forgot to care if I won the contest. I'd played, and that was all that really mattered. Aaron was the happiest I'd seen her in years, and my mom had hugged me, actually hugged me. It was a brief embrace, over almost the instant it began, before I could even acknowledge the hunger that raised its voice at contact with another person. But it was enough to tell me that something had changed between us tonight. Maybe the apprehension she'd held toward me since Jason Dunn's death was finally starting to fade. And then there was Blake, who kept staring at me when he thought I wasn't aware, smiling like he was reliving a happy memory, who told me 100 times already how great I'd been, how the audience had loved me, how they'd gone still and silent the moment I started playing, and hadn't seemed to breathe until I was finished. Blake, who made me feel good about myself, made me feel like I deserved to feel good. He stretched his fingers on the steering wheel, like a race car driver about to jam the pedal to the floor. "Any particular destination in mind?" "No destination. Let's just keep moving forward." I leaned back in my seat and let my head loll toward Blake. The glow of the dashboard gauges created a rim light that traced his profile. This is probably going to sound dramatic, but everything seems different now.
Maybe it is.
His smile faded and he looked at me for a moment, nodding seriously. Heat crept into my cheeks and gathered in my stomach. My will to resist Blake was weakening, and I wasn't sure I cared anymore. Ahead, I saw the turn off to the long drive that cut through several hundred yards of forest before reaching my house. An unfamiliar brown Bronco was parked on the side of the road next to our mailbox.
"Whose truck is this?" Blake asked,
slowing into a turn and then pulling up next to the SUV. Both of us peered into the cab, but saw no one inside.
I shrugged.
Maybe the driver broke down and didn't have a cell phone to call a tow truck.
"Who doesn't have a cell phone?" Blake asked.
He'd moved to the mid-size Oregon town of Rushing from a pristine Connecticut suburb, where I imagined no one ever abandoned a broken-down SUV next to his mailbox. Or if they did, it would be promptly hauled away. Blake accelerated slowly and continued down the gravel driveway to my house.
"What happened to driving all night?"
I asked, trying not to sound disappointed. Blake glanced over at me.
"You were serious about that?"
"Nah," I lied, and forced a laugh. "You know me. Spontaneity is my mortal enemy. Pull over here, okay? I don't want my mom to hear your car and wake up." I was supposed to be home by midnight. It was almost 2. Frowning, Blake slowed and steered onto the shoulder under a canopy of trees. He was probably counting the number of points he'd lose with my mom for keeping me out past curfew. Respectable young man that he was. "Relax," I told him. "I'll sneak in through the basement window so she won't hear the front door. I have a whole system."
"You do this often?" he asked, raising an eyebrow.
"Well, I probably shouldn't tell you this because my order has a code and everything, but I'm a vampire slayer, which involves a lot of late-night outings." I was relieved when he chuckled and let the subject drop. I didn't want to tell him what I really did at night when I couldn't sleep. Didn't want to admit how often I snuck out and went to the place where I'd buried Clint Eastwood and her kittens. I brought my guitar, sat with my back against the nearby tree, and I played to the pile of smooth stones, and sang so softly I was almost silent. I did it because sometimes it was too much temptation to be in a house at night with 2 helpless sleeping people. 2 people who could provide the same thing Jason Dunn had provided. A way to be free from myself for a little while. So I played music instead, because it was the only thing that kept me grounded, kept me under control.
"You went away," Blake said.
I blinked and focused on him, realizing I'd been staring out the window in silence for a long moment. "Yeah, I guess I did." He smiled in that shy way he had that made me feel like I was the bold one.
"I'm going to remember tonight for the rest of my life," he said, and then laughed and lowered his eyes. "Now that sounds dramatic."
Then I guess I like dramatic. I found myself leaning toward Blake across the console. I heard the knocking of my own heartbeat, or maybe it was Blake's I was hearing, or both, beating perfectly in sync. He looked at me, his eyes the color of newly minted pennies. The cedar and honey smell of his cologne in my lungs made me feel off-kilter, half-dreaming, like I'd inhaled some kind of intoxicating hallucinogen. Blake began to lean toward me, too, but I froze as the rational voice in my head spoke up, reminding me about my rule, which was for his own good as much as mine. Blake was the best friend I'd ever had, and taking things to the next level meant I would risk losing him. But could I really exist in this state of limbo with him forever? Both of us wanting more and me always saying no. Wouldn't that end the friendship just as surely? I better go. I took a deep breath and opened the car door. The grumble of the engine died. I glanced back at Blake.
"I'll walk you," he said.
"You don't have to," I told him, but I didn't mean it. Part of not wanting the night to end was not wanting to say goodnight to Blake, even though technically he lived next door to me. In our neck of the woods, which mostly consisted of actual woods, next door meant our houses were separated by a couple hundred yards of forest. Not that I minded living so many miles from town proper. surrounded by trees with a river running through our backyard and the mountains looming. I felt isolated from civilization, and I figured I was better off that way. Easier to stay away from people when you lived like a witch in the woods.
There's no way I'm going to let you wander off in the dark, especially with that mystery truck parked by your mailbox, Blake said.
Then who's going to walk you back to your car?
He thumped his fist against his chest.
I am man. I walk the world alone without fear.
I turned my face away so Blake wouldn't see me smile. Blake was almost as skinny as I was, despite his addiction to any and all kinds of cookies. His favorite joke was to buy a box of cookies and then check the ingredient list and say,
interesting. These cookies contain 100% of my daily requirement for cookies.
When he found out my mom owned a bakery, I thought he might do a backflip. What about my guitar? I asked, gesturing toward the trunk.
I'll bring it to you tomorrow, he said. Good excuse for me to show up at your house unannounced.
I hesitated. I hadn't spent a night without my guitar since my mom gave it to me. But if I trusted anyone with it, it was Blake. When have you ever needed an excuse before? I asked, batting my eyelashes at him. He feigned shock.
Careful, or I'll revoke your oatmeal raisin surprise cookie privileges.
You never told me what the surprise was.
The raisins, he said, as though this should have been obvious.
You refer to them as oatmeal raisin cookies. That kind of ruins the surprise.
The surprise is that most people hate raisins and oatmeal cookies, but in these you actually like them.
You're so weird.
But you like weird.
That's right, I do. I smiled. He smiled. I swallowed. He cleared his throat.
Well, I guess that's enough witty banter for now.
We both laughed, breaking the tension, and started up the road, our shoes crunching on the gravel. Mom had been meaning to get the drive paved for as long as we'd lived in our house, just like she'd always meant to finish the basement, but she'd never quite gotten around to either task. Aaron's medical bills exceeded what her insurance covered, so there was rarely much extra money lying around at the end of every month. Not that any of the treatments or medications or studies had helped Aaron, nor had they answered any of the questions we had about her condition. But Mom couldn't sit back and do nothing. A breeze moved through the trees and caught my hair, lifting it and chilling the skin of my neck. The moon overhead appeared to have been sliced cleanly in half. The cool air was sharp with the scent of pine trees, a smell that reminded most people of Christmas, but not me. I'd heard a person's sense of smell was closely linked with memory, and the tang of pine trees often sent me back to my time lost in the forest after killing Jason, bombarding me with fractured snippets of recollection, of charging through trees, my blood surging with rapturous, sparkling, effervescent energy, the forest bending and warping around me, trunks twisting and bowling over me, and the sunlight pouring down through the cracks in a waterfall of liquid light. Of night, when the stars began to fall like snow, and the moon was close enough to touch like a reflection in a pond. Even now, I awoke from surreal, kaleidoscopic dreams that felt like dreams within dreams, memories of what it had felt like to be lost in the woods and lost to myself. And I wanted it again, so badly I could hardly draw breath, and had to take a dozen hits on my asthma inhaler to make my lungs open up for plain old air. For 2 days, I had lived that intoxicating dream while search parties scoured the woods looking for me. They had even tried to search Eclipse, the bohemian commune situated in an isolated valley nestled on the other side of the Cross Pine Mountains. The people at Eclipse lived in seclusion, only driving into town when they had to buy supplies they couldn't grow or make themselves. The search party had nearly come to blows with the Eclipse people, who'd refused to let them in. But before a warrant could be acquired, I had woken from my dream and returned home to the terrible reality of what I had done. I lied to everyone but my mom, told them I'd seen Jason drop dead, and I'd been so scared I ran away. Ran and ran until I was lost. And everyone believed me, with the exception of Thomas Dunn, Jason's dad. He told anyone who would listen that I was a demon who had drained the life right out of his son. He ranted and raved about the evil child next door until they locked him up. I wondered sometimes if it would help Mr. Dunn, to know that his precious Jason wasn't the golden boy he remembered, that he was as much a monster as I was. Blake was unusually quiet as we walked. Normally, he never shut up. Blake was a chatterer, the kind of person who always broke an awkward silence, even if it was with the most random statement that popped into his head. Did you know mosquitoes are completely unnecessary to the ecological balance of nature? Did you know that about 7 babies are born every second? Did you know the lead guitar player for Queen has a PhD in astrophysics? I glanced over at him as we walked, wondering how much he'd heard about Jason Dunn's death. He had to know something. People still talked about it. How could they not? Rushing had a population of only 20,000 people. Jason's death was the most interesting thing that had ever happened here. We reached the place where the woods met my front lawn, and I turned to Blake, feeling as though I were standing under a spotlight. His brows were drawn together and tilted in an expression of worried concentration. There were things I wanted to say, but they scattered like a pile of fall leaves kicked by a sharp wind, and all that was left was what I wanted to do. Before I could stop myself, I stepped toward Blake, putting my mouth so near to his that I was breathing him in. We weren't touching, weren't kissing. We paused in before, balanced on a tightrope between what we were and what we would become if either of us moved. "Kenna," he said, sounding excited and worried. Whatever concerns he had, I didn't give him a chance to speak them, because then my own concern would rear their ugly heads. I brushed my lips against his, feeling the energy buzzing beneath his skin, but I was careful not to want it, not to open myself to it. After a brief moment of hesitation, his mouth sighed open and overlapped mine. He tasted like brown sugar and cinnamon. His kiss was just like him, considerate, gentlemanly, sweet. It frustrated the hell out of me. After so much time spent keeping him, keeping all guys, all people, at a safe distance, I was finally ready to let one of them in. I wanted more than a polite kiss. I made my lips softer but kissed him harder. He responded, arms wrapping me, fingers burrowing into my hair. A sublime sense of vertigo, a magnetic gravity overcame me. I was falling and standing at the same time. Our kiss became less considerate, more impatient and eager. And there it was, the ferocity under the sweetness, the rogue under the clean-cut boy next door. Blake's teeth nipped at my bottom lip, his tongue skimmed mine. A low groan purred in his throat. My temperature rose until it felt like a fever, a delicious sickness, the kind that could wipe out an entire population. My fingertips, calloused and always slightly numb from infinite hours spent playing guitar, dug into his back. But I was careful. I kept a grip on the old, greedy need that lived inside me. Distantly, I heard a noise like a cry, but I ignored it, kept kissing him. Desperate now, starved for this, starved for him as much as I'd been starved for the light I'd taken from Jason Dunn. The cry came again, and Blake pulled back so suddenly he left me reeling, swaying on my feet.
"What was that?" he said.
I heard it again, though I still wasn't sure what it was. My skin prickled in primal warning. It sounded like someone, a person, crying out in despair or pain. But there were birds that made that sort of sound, birds and other creatures like mountain lions with their furious shrieks. This close to the forest, plenty of animals confused our property with theirs, some of them more dangerous than others.
"Let's get you inside," Blake said decisively.
Blake walked me to the basement window, which was on the opposite end of the house from my mom's bedroom. Reading the disappointment on my face, he cupped my cheek with one hand, in a gesture I'd only seen men use in movies. My skin thrilled and yearned for more. I felt the glowing life inside him, but what I craved at that moment was him, just Blake. His mouth and his arms and his touch and his warmth. I didn't want to take anything from inside him. I only wanted to stay next to him, to bask in the closeness of him.
"Nothing changes," he said.
"Or everything does," I pointed out.
"For someone who wears as much gray as you do, you have a tendency to only think in black and white,"
I started to deny this, but his lips shut me up and his soft, summer-warm mouth made me forget all about the cry until it came again.
Good night, he whispered. Get your ass inside where it's safe.
My ass would be safer with you. Just come in with me and sneak out when it's light. He considered this for a moment before shaking his head.
I'm out past curfew too, remember? And I can't exactly call my parents at 2 in the morning and tell them I'm spending the night at your house. They're cool, but not that cool.
He kissed me one more time and started jogging back in the direction from which we'd come. Feeling unmoored, I slid the basement window open and lowered myself inside, then stood there a moment in the dark, leaning against the cold wall. The unfinished basement consisted of concrete floors and framed-in rooms, but only one had drywall and doors. My stomach was giddy, lodged somewhere between my lungs. Me and Blake. Blake and me. It was amazing how